the show.
Well, hey everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, here with The Boundless Show for another episode this week. Very excited to have you joining us. This week's podcast sponsor, I want to make sure I give them a shout, is, again, I think they were a couple weeks ago, the book Unplanned. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, it is the story of Abby Johnson, who was a former director of Planned Parenthood down in Texas, and now actually works with a pregnancy medical clinic down there after having assisted basically in an abortion herself and deciding, wow, this is something that I cannot devote the rest of my life to. So that book has just come out. She is also featured on our daily broadcast. So you want to make sure you check that out at focusonthefamily.com and get the book at family.christianbook.com. So thanks for sponsoring us, publishers, and the book specifically, Unplanned. Okay, so first up at the end of the show, we have a listener question related to basically dreaming things that are sexual in nature. So not really sure what to do with that. So we're going to invite one of our counseling staff in. Danny Huerta is going to come and tackle that one for us. So very interesting question and can't wait to hear what he says about that. And then for our culture segment this week, those of you that are fans of Moody Radio, Anita Lustria hosts their national show Midday Connection, and she is here to talk about her book, What Women Tell Me. And guys, don't tune out. There's a lot that you can learn from this as well, but it's basically based on a number of interviews that she did with women across the country on kind of the secrets that we keep. And so what are those things, even within Christian community, that we're holding to ourselves and not gaining benefit from, in the sense of what needs to be shared, what can we learn from one another, what needs to be confessed? There's a lot to talk about there. So but since we are kind of continuing our January theme of just a number of different things heading into the new year and kind of life and what we're doing with our lives in 2011, we decided to tackle the idea of clutter on this week's show and just kind of the stuff in our lives. And what is it? Is it choking the life out of us? What do we need to do differently related to our stuff? Those of you who follow our e-newsletter, which you can sign up for on our site, do it. Know that I talked about spiritual clutter in the e-newsletter probably about a month ago. But now we're just going to talk about stuff in general and how it kind of moves with us throughout our life and what we need to do about it. So let me go ahead and introduce who we have with us today. First of all, we have Nathan Hubler. Nathan, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Nathan is part of our Adventures in Odyssey team here at Focus on the Family. He is an Odyssey Uber fan and expert on all things Adventures in Odyssey. He's also a tour guide extraordinaire when it comes to Odyssey. So we have like tons of kids that come through Focus and not so young kids that come that want to hear how Odyssey is produced and what happens and how they come up with story ideas and how they do all the sound effects. And Nathan kind of guides them through that experience, including he also comes up with a good number of the storylines for Odyssey and really helps make that show happen. So how many years do we have of Odyssey under our belt now, Nathan?
Well, I haven't been here for all of them, but it's been going for just over 23 years now.
Okay. Because Nathan's only like 24.
So. A little older than that.
But yeah, so he's part of that whole experience. So that's pretty awesome. Can't believe it's been around that long and that you guys still come up with fresh ideas for that.
Whoa. 25 years is just around the corner.
Oh, my word. Okay. So we also have Martha back in the studio. Martha.
Hello. How's your,
hey, here she is. So she's still with us. She hasn't left Boundless yet, so that's exciting. So despite the welcome Martha post that has taken on a number of different directions.
That's true. But a warm welcome? I don't know.
Yeah. Warm. It's, yeah, we're still welcoming her despite the many ancillary conversations that have happened on that post. But so she's here to join the conversation as well. And then Kathy Holman, want to welcome Kathy.
Hi there.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Yay. Well, Kathy, I'm excited to have because she is a Colorado Springs resident here, someone who's in the fray here in town, but is a kind of our expert on the panel today because she is a personal organizer. She has clients that she works with. She also has her own housekeeping business. Mm-hmm. So she is very well acquainted with people and their stuff and having to maneuver around it.
Yes, very much so.
So she has that look of weariness about her of just thinking of what she may have to deal with probably later in the day. So So I'm excited to hear some of her experiences and some of her insight as well. So let's jump right into the topic. I thought it was kind of an interesting topic because I was talking with one of my friends a couple weeks ago. And I'd gone over to her place and helped her weed through one of her closets and just a number of clothes that she had. And it was kind of like I sat there and pulled things out and basically in the span of about an hour just gave her a no. Okay, yeah, this one's good. Keep it. No, this one has like dust all over it. When was the last time you wore this? And we were talking about the fact that she owns her own townhome that has two bedrooms, I believe. Then she has a central kind of closet in her upstairs hall. All of the closets are filled with her own clothes. And so we have this conversation of, were you to ever get married, would you have to move to another location that has more closets, or would your husband just not have to wear any clothes because there's no space for him, basically? And so it kind of prompted us to think about, wow, you know, what is our, you know, the volume of stuff that we have ourselves and what would we be willing to part with and what not? So let's just throw it out there in general and talk about our own experience kind of with clutter or non-clutter, kind of our feelings toward it. Nathan, why don't you launch into where you are with stuff?
Sure. Well, I think one of the reasons that we're hesitant to get rid of stuff sometimes is because we feel like it's wasteful to get rid of things. And in fact, I think if you think through it, it can be the opposite, that this thing that you have might not be giving any value to you. It's just sitting there for years in your closet, not being used. Whereas if you were to give it to someone else, give it to Goodwill, then someone else might be able to use it and it wouldn't be sitting there wasting in your closet. I know that for years I kept magazines just thinking, well, maybe someday I'll go back and read those. And of course, I'm never going to go back and ever read those magazines again. And even if I did want to find a particular article, these days so much is online. So it's much more valuable to be able to give those things away to someone else who might be able to use them instead of just having them sit there and collect dust.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. I mean, that's funny that you mentioned magazines because I think I had a similar situation, and I have a friend actually who has stacked up all these magazines throughout his living room and like claims that he's going to go through them systematically. And I'm like, wow, well, there goes a big chunk of your life having to set aside time for that. My goodness. Whoa.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. What about you, Kathy?
Well, I'm in a marriage where my husband actually has less of a problem with clutter than I do. And I'm in a profession, obviously, where I am helping people that have issues with clutter. And it's something that I actually have to deal with myself. But it keeps me on the journey. I go to somebody's home and see their problems with clutter. And I'm going, I don't want to get here. Mm-hmm. I don't want to end up there. So I'm going to keep getting rid of things, and it really does help me stay the journey.
Yeah. I guess it probably wouldn't be the best, the best marketing ploy for you to have a disastrous home yourself and then be out decluttering everyone else's.
I definitely try to stay honest. Mm-hmm. I figure it's good for business.
Okay, Martha, what
about you? I don't consider myself, you know, having to struggle with clutter stuff, but I am frugal, so I like to save things because you never know when you might need to use it. Like, I do a lot of like making cards and like crafty kind of things. So I'll save random pieces of ribbon or buttons or pieces of paper, and that can definitely add up. But I also find it useful later. So is that okay?
I'm not entirely sure if that's okay. We'll have to talk about it. So are you saying, I mean, are you talking about like you have tubs of this stuff or you have like a little thing of ribbons?
It's like a Ziploc bag size.
Oh, that's not bad.
Wow. Okay. That's okay. Totally. I feel better.
Yeah. I have a friend who we helped move her a couple years ago, and it was kind of one of these like moving from the basement of someone's house, and then like a good portion of her stuff had to go into a storage unit, and then we had to move the rest of her stuff into her new place. And we moved, I can't remember how many tubs it was, I would say 12 or 13 tubs of like yarn and stuff, because she knits and all this. And I'm like, when in this foreseeable future are you going to be using 13 tubs of yarn? Like, honestly, can we not just have one tub of yarn and then you can buy more yarn? So, you know, stuff like that. I always like super get all judgy of people. Like, whenever we move people, I'm like, what is all this stuff? How come they have this stuff? So anyway, it's kind of funny. I think I've mentioned to the Boundless audience that I've been in the process of about a 3-year declutter of my house, which I don't understand how this is happening because I don't like clutter and I don't like a ton of stuff. I don't have any collections as far as I can recall. But I am get the life sucked out of me by paper, by dealing with even with like mail, you know, I'll throw my junk mail away, but then just the stuff that I have to actually deal with. I've kind of systematically started, like, once I made the move to like online bill pay and doing all that, that was good. And just not dealing with all these little slips of paper and whatever. So that's kind of one of my things. The other thing is, like trade show swag. When I go to a lot of conferences, I go to, and they're always giving you stuff. And I feel like there, I'm like, you know, if someone's going to give me, a Christian publisher is going to give me like 5 books, I can't just chuck those in the trash. That's like crazy. So then I have them, then I feel obligated to like, who would be the best person to receive this? And it just like sits in my house until I figure that out. So meanwhile, it's just like stacking up and all that kind of stuff. So.
I'd take some of that off your hands.
I know. Okay, well, Martha, we're going to have like a little... Sometimes I bring it, I'll bring it to my Sunday school class and I'll just put stuff out and be like, here are like books or, you know, whatever, or CDs, you know, from different people or...
Or church library, maybe. A lot of churches have a church library.
That, actually, I did that at Christmas. I came and I brought a whole... I packed a whole bag of stuff and brought it to Minnesota to bring to my mom's church to include in her library because she's in a smallish country church, you know, and they probably don't have any budget whatsoever for their church library. So they always get excited about stuff like that. So that's one thing I do. The other thing, the trade show thing, you know, trade show bags, like tote bags and stuff. Mm. I had like 15 tote bags that I'd gotten from different shows. So I bring those back to Minnesota and my mom distributes them to all the little old ladies for their books and stuff. And they get all excited. They're like, I don't have this bag.
Lisa, so. You have some great strategies.
I have these strategies, but I'm just like, it's like a full-time job keeping up with like getting rid of stuff. I don't know.
It is. It's an obligation once we have the things.
Yeah.
And sometimes we just procrastinate. We that's what clutter really represents, is just postponed decisions and actions. And some days we're going to have to deal with it, whether we move and have to pay to have it moved and have second thoughts about whether we want to invest that money in having it moved, or maybe somebody will have to deal with it when we die. And I've been in situations like that.
Like if I think to myself, if I died today and someone went through my house, would that even be okay?
Right.
Because I think there would be some scariness and it just kind of, you know, is a little leery. Yeah, I'm a little leery of that.
But yeah, clutter does represent an obligation of some sort to us or someone after us to take care of it. And it can be weighty the more stuff we have.
So would you say, Kathy, in your experience with clients, and like we said on the front end of the show, you were a personal organizer, what are the biggest clutter traps for people? And I threw this out on Facebook on the boundless.org page, which fan us if you haven't, and tell your friends to do so too. I threw this out, and some of the big responses were books, textbooks, you know, different collectibles, computer stuff.
Yeah.
What do you see when you're in people's homes?
I see an issue with books and clothes primarily, and then paper. Those would be the top three. And we get very attached to things. And in order to actually get rid of things, we have to go back to when did we get attached to this and are we willing to let it go? What usually prompts us to let things go is that we're reaching towards something new. And whatever that is, that vision, that... something has encouraged us, given us hope that we want something different. And at that point, we're willing to let go.
Yeah.
That is what motivates people, in my experience, to get rid of things. And myself as well. I have a vision of what I want my house to look like. And in order to do that, things have to go. And I'm willing to do that at that point.
Okay. Do you think most people just don't see their own stuff? Do you think they've just lived in it so long that they don't realize that they're just moving things from pile to pile and
In fact, I was just talking with a 27-year-old last night who told me he really didn't have an issue with clutter. He was in the military for 8 years, and the military really does... stress. They actually require you to have just a certain amount of things that they'll move for you. And he went from having everything he owned in a backpack to now he's sharing a spacious home with three other guys. And he said, I don't really have an issue with clutter. But as we talked, he looked around and he said, oh, now I'm seeing things with new eyes. And he realized just as we were talking that he had some issues with clutter.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I remember the days when I could move in my car, you know, and the amount of stuff I had, I could move in a Mazda 323. Those days are long gone. I've owned my house now for 6 years, and now I just have one cabinet of small appliances. And I'm like, really? Do I need a snow cone maker? Someone had given me a snow cone maker. I have it. I still haven't unloaded it because I have this grand idea that I'm going to host snow cone parties. And we're just going to like have people over and make snow cones. And it's going to be really fun. But I haven't done that yet. And I've had this thing for at least 5 years. So it's like kind of those things where you're like, oh, sure. My word. You know, you think you're going to use it. You know, it's just kind of fun.
The s'mores makers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I have one of those.
See? Maybe. Fondue pots, all these things that people get for different one-stop, you know, one-stop shopping kind of things. So it's pretty
funny. They come out at all the holidays, especially Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going, I don't know what to get Mom. I think she needs a s'mores maker.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you don't know what to get people.
Ah!
So what about, that kind of is a good entree into this side topic, and that is the idea of gift giving and receiving. Because I have a lot of friends who are unwilling to get rid of gifts that they've gotten from people. Hmm. So they get, you know, sure, a completely hideous sweater from their mom for Christmas, but well, you know, maybe she's going to want to see me in it, or maybe I can't really say that I didn't, you know, keep it. And, you know, so a lot of people accumulate things that they don't care for, that aren't their style, that, you know, maybe don't even fit or whatever, sure, but they're still keeping it. So where do people put that stuff? I mean, do you know people that have that? Do you ever get that? It's kind of
maybe,
like, with women, it's candles. This is my thing. It's like candles are what you give women when you don't really know them that well, but you need to get them something.
Sure.
Or like notepads, you know, like little cute, like refrigerator notepads and stuff. Yeah, you get a lot of those. So, just from people. I'm just saying.
I kind of look at it this way, that would I want somebody to clutter up their lives with things that I gave them that they really didn't like? Mm-hmm. And I would honestly give them all the freedom they need to get rid of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the gifts, frankly, that I give are real losers. And boy, let's just not keep that around to remind me of that crazy gift that I gave you.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask you three here, just I've thought about this topic the last few Christmases, because I think, am I getting someone a gift that they can't use, and so essentially I'm kind of wasting this money?
Mm-hmm.
As a guy, I like getting gift cards because then I can get whatever I want, but is there still a negative feeling when you get a gift card? You think, oh, they didn't actually think to get a gift, or is that now more acceptable?
What do you guys think?
To keep, you know, keep them from getting clutter that they don't want, to keep them to...
I think it's a great idea.
Hmm.
I think that it reduces clutter. It reduces the amount of time that it takes just to do the gift transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for it.
Hmm.
I find it a little weird when, like, you have a amount to spend and I give you a $15 gift card and you give me a $15 gift card. Like, I think you lose the spirit of Christmas in that. So I'd probably prefer that someone would ask me for some ideas. And
sure.
Yeah. I think it depends on who it is. Like, for me, when it's like the coworker situation or something, you know, clients or whatever, I'm all about gift cards.
Mm.
If I were to receive a Christmas gift card from like my sister, I would probably be, seriously, you've known me for 30 plus years and you just come up with something. So I'd be a little bit more harsh, I think, on that on that front.
Sure.
But I'm all of it. Would I rather receive a gift card or a pear scented candle, you know, gift card? Yeah, because it's kind of when it's that obligatory gift situation, gift cards all the way, I think, would be my pick for sure. But yeah, I guess it kind of depends. But so let's talk a little bit about this was another one of the caveats of, you know, looking towards kind of planning to marry, preparing to marry young adults who know that, you know, maybe they're in their 20s, maybe 30s now. You've had a chunk of time maybe to accumulate some stuff. You have your stuff. I actually was just finishing clearing out my garage probably last month, and went through the tub of what I call memorabilia. So stuff that I have, you know, the grade school projects, the college papers, the prom, whatever, corsage, that kind of stuff. And I'm a big fan. I finally went through and there were a few things in there where I was like, I am going to take a picture of this and chuck
it. What a great idea.
I do not need to have this dried corsage sitting in here. Basically sitting in my garage, because unless I'm going to like shadow box it and give it a prominent place in my home, what is the purpose of this? Okay. So I started taking pictures of a few things and even some like certificates that I gotten for things. But I got that thing down to like about half a tub of stuff at this point of what I have. And I've thought to myself, you know, yeah, wow, what if I were to get married in the near future and have to consolidate my stuff with someone else's? You know, what would that look like? And would that even be feasible, and how do you kind of merge households in that kind of sense? And I often ask, maybe I'll ask you guys this too, I'll throw it out, Kathy, you'll probably have a real situation here, but a question I love to ask people is, if you were to get married, what is the first thing that you own that your spouse would force you to get rid of? What is
a couple of things.
Okay, go ahead, Nathan.
I think through, and I've been kind of searching for a practical rule on this, so maybe you guys can tell me just as far as like an amount of time, like if I only look at this thing once every 2 years, is that something I really need to get rid of? Or for the most part, I don't keep things like that, but there are sentimental things that you think, oh, I just hate to throw this away, but I never use it, but you know, this does have a memory attached to it. So those are probably things I could get rid of, but I keep, you know, every time I come to it when I'm going through an organization or whatever, I think, I hate to throw it away. So is there any kind of a rule that you guys have come up with for amount of time or size how do you decide what you keep that has some sentimental value?
One thing I've thought of is, would I buy this at Goodwill for like clothes or decorations and stuff? Of if this is really that outdated that I wouldn't even buy it at this point, then maybe it's time to go back to Goodwill.
Except if it were for like an ugly sweater party.
That's true. We got to save those.
Or Halloween.
Would someone else buy this item for Halloween at Goodwill? That would be a sobering thought.
That's really putting the bar low.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. I think it's interesting how many, I think for women, it really is one of the huge problems is keeping clothes in a number of different sizes, kind of the whole, but I wore this skirt in high school and I'm sure that someday I'm going to get back in it. Well, you know, really, is it, you know, that's 20 years ago now, so maybe we should reconsider. You see a lot of that, I think.
I've never thought that.
The wish clothes. I wish I could wear this. And I don't think that it's a wish based in reality for a lot of people, and we just need to go on. But it's hard to let go of those dreams and hopes, but it's good to have a friend there to hold our hands, or someone like me that can hold your hand, and just it's hard to do it by yourself. And so it's a grieving process in a way. You're losing. It represents a loss. Those clothes represent a loss on some level, a loss of who we once were. That in some ways we wish we were still there, that size or whatever. But we just need to focus on the future. What am I reaching towards?
What, Nathan, what are some of the big traps for guys, would you say? Like guys that you know, stuff that they have. I mean, my assumption, and from what I've seen guys get really attached to like sports equipment or electronics. And I've been in guys' houses where they've got like old nasty skis just sitting around that they're not going to actually use.
Sure.
Or bindings are broken, but there's some attachment to them. Or now I know Nathan, I have to call him out on this because his house is like an REI, basically. He's got a climbing wall in his living room, which is a whole other show altogether. But not in a cluttery way, but you definitely like your stuff. You climb a lot. You do a lot of hiking. You do a lot of, you know, I'm on your Facebook page and I'm just like, this looks like something out of National Geographic, but it's just Nathan's weekend. so he does a lot of that. But what do you see for guys as being the traps?
I think sports equipment can be one, because that may be the equivalent of clothes with women, is that they think back to the time that they were playing hockey or or skiing on these skis or whatever. And so there are memories attached to those. With guys I know, I see a lot of books too, you know, that people just get vast bookshelves. And I don't think that's inherently wrong. But, you know, if you have these bookshelves of books that you read once that you have, you'll never go back to, why do you need to keep them? Another one I see with guys is paperwork, you know, that stuff that you did for work or for college or whatever that you have, you might have saved on your computer, but you keep the printouts. But why do you need to keep that? Is there some special memory attached that you really need to go back and keep that?
Yeah. I know when I was going through my college papers, one thing that would cause me to keep it was, you know, if it had some the markings of my professor or something, and if something was said, but I was like, I can't keep every one of these, just keep a few of them as a sample, you know, whatever. So I had to kind of go through. And
do you still have any of them, Lisa?
Yeah, I kept a few.
Okay.
Like, I kept a few that I knew were like large, you know, big term papers where my professor had written some kind of comment on it about, you know, this was great because blah blah blah, but not just a grade on it with a good job or something like that.
So some sort of feedback, personal comment, is what made it valuable.
Yeah. And my problem is, too, you know, I was in college in an era where we were dealing with floppy disks. It's not like I have all these things electronically still.
Yeah. So. Well, that, when you mentioned floppy disks, that's another thing I see in myself and with other guys I know, is just electronics, like outdated. Oh. You know, the computer that you've replaced years ago and the old computer is still sitting there. Why, you know, you can never, the programs won't even run on it anymore.
Right.
Why aren't we keeping this old electronics or cables or printers? Why are we keeping those around anymore?
Mm-hmm. Like massive dust collectors.
Mm-hmm. I was speaking with a friend of one of my kids. He's 27 as well, and he actually has a rule about books in his house. And I really thought it was a great rule to share today. He said that his rule is he'll only keep books that he can highly recommend to others. Mm. And so his collection is confined not only by that rule, but by the space in his bookshelf. He says it's pretty much a rule of proportions. If you've got room for it in a bookshelf, then you can have it. And then all of his books are in bookshelves. They're not just laying around. And then he said, if it's worth keeping, it's worth treating with the honor that it's due. Dust collecting in piles, those don't really show that it that we're honoring it.
Yeah. So. Well, and I think especially when it comes down to like fiction, I'm like, this is why we have libraries, people. I mean, I understand, you know, I have
Nathan might disagree with that one.
Well, it's like, for example, again, getting back to women, you don't need 5 editions of Pride and Prejudice. I mean, I know women that buy classics because, oh, my word, Mr. Darcy, I just need to, you know, memorialize him in my library. Well, you know what? You don't need 5 copies of that. And
but
quite
you
frankly,
do have to have both copies of the movies.
Right. Well, the movies, you know, that's a whole other story. You know,
the 5-hour and the 3-hour one.
Yeah, exactly. You do have to have that. But, you know, the idea of, and I think, you know, let's, because we can kind of turn a corner now and talk a little bit about strategies for decluttering and what really are some good ways. And one great example that a friend of mine has done now is she went out and bought a Kindle, you know, or you could buy a Nook, whatever you want to. And she's starting to get rid of physical copies of her books and get them on her Kindle. And so, you know, doing that, recognizing, you know, this is another female trap, is going to women's conferences and buying every book that they offer you there.
Sure.
Are you going to read these books? Are you going to actually go home and take these conference books and apply them to your life? You know, it's like the Christian self-help trap of everyone like, this book is going to change my life. Well, you know, then you don't read it and it just sits there.
And so it makes us feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of that too.
Because we haven't, What are some other good, you know, decluttering tactics for different types of things that you've seen?
I'll just jump in while we were talking about books. A former roommate of mine, Josh, I think had a really good idea, and that he would get a lot of books at conferences and so on, and he had a shelf of them, and whenever anyone would come over to the house, one of the things that he'd do is bring them down to the bookshelf and say, you know, take a couple books.
Oh, okay.
And so they'd look through the shelf and see something that looked interesting, and so when people came over, you know, that was just one of the normal things that he did, was say, take some books off my hands, and they're not doing me any good. I've either read them or I'm, you know, just keeping them sitting here, so why don't you take them and you can use them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good idea. Anything else?
Once your bookshelves are full, just it's the one in, one out rule. Mm. As soon as you get one book in, one's got to go.
Yeah.
So
that's a good, I think that's a good tactic for clothes too.
Sure.
For almost anything. Yeah. You know, if you get a new piece of electronics, what's something you can get rid of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you have 50 sweaters folded on your shelves, maybe some of those need to go, and you need to feasibly decide what you can wear and what you can't wear, and you know, that kind of stuff.
And the whole idea of giving everything you own a home, that's really crucial to keeping the clutter at bay and just keeping things where you can find them.
Yeah.
You just make sure that everything has its own place.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I like the idea, I've heard people talk too about when you're going through and decluttering your home, get rid of the stuff and put it in a black hefty bag.
Yeah.
Because if it's out of sight, if you can't see it, you know, if it's not there just looking back at you and saying, please keep me, your chances of getting it to Goodwill are a lot higher, you know, and it might be a better, you know, better means of... I've had stuff like that where I put it, you know, in my garage, and like 6 months later I saw it there and I'm like, I didn't even miss this thing. So that's kind of a good motivator for me to be like, done, you're just out.
I think having a donation box or a bag going all the time is a really great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And just make that a regular part of our routine.
Yeah. I think that's cool. All right. Well, good thoughts, you guys. I mean, I think this is a good discussion starter. Obviously, we didn't even get to touch on everything that could be said on this topic. There are a lot of different directions we can go, but we want to hear from you guys. So make sure that when you see this post come up, that you weigh in and give us your thoughts about decluttering or things that are just kind of choking the life out of you as you move or as you attempt to keep your house clean. Even an area that we didn't even touch on was the whole idea of the inability to invite people into your home and to use your home as a place of, you know, whether for Bible studies or just for building community or whatever, because you've got so much stuff that you don't have any place or any breathing room for people to be invited in and kind of have that be a welcoming place. So and there are a lot of challenges with clutter and with stuff and what it can really do to us and the spiritual implications of that and being tied to our stuff. I think that's huge. So so go ahead and give us your thoughts, folks out there, as to what you think about your stuff and maybe some ideas. We can share some ideas of getting rid of our stuff in 2011. So thanks, everyone. Well, hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am privileged to be in the studio with Anita Lustria. Anita, welcome.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
Anita is, for many of you who know, because I know a lot of you listen to Moody Radio, she is both the executive producer and the host of Moody's Midday Connection, which has a large female listening audience, though I would say it runs the gamut for sure. But
yeah.
a lot of ladies on there listening during the day.
Geared mostly toward women. We hear from the male listener. Often we'll get these emails saying, you know, I'm coming out of the closet and letting you know that I'm listening as a man, and it's helped me in my female relationships with my
sisters. Or they weigh in on your Facebook page
spouse.
And they're like, what are you guys talking about?
I'm exactly.
So that's always good. I've checked in on those conversations a little bit too. And a lot of you out there know that I was actually on their show on with Anita on the earlier part of this year talking about singleness. And
huge
just,
response, by the way.
It
I mean,
was.
It's a big topic, an important topic, and we got a big response too because, you know, half of your audience came and listened too, which
was
great.
Between your show and Chris Fabry's show, which I did in kind of close proximity, I was telling people, and I can't remember if I mentioned it here on the show, but I answered email for probably 3 weeks solid after that. People that found me on Facebook, women that, especially women, who emailed me, you know, at the show, and they generally it was, up until I heard you on Anita's show, I thought I was the only single woman out there who still wanted to get married, who still struggled with loneliness, who still, and so, you know, you people will speak up when you're out there, and especially if you share some of your own stories.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Which is very apropos because we are going to be talking to you today. If there's anyone who knows what women are talking about and women are thinking about, it is Anita, because these women talk to her. Yeah. They, like I referenced her Facebook page, they're on Facebook. They are able to contact the show. She knows all about them and knows them. And as a result, she has written What Women Tell Me, Finding Freedom from the Secrets We Keep. And it is no secret that women struggle.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It's no secret that women feel like they need a place to talk about those struggles, and maybe they feel like they don't have a safe place to do that. Though women, by and large, are relational, you would say.
Yeah, I think women are extremely relational on one level, but they struggle going to a deeper level relationally, which is where we tend to share those deeper, darker secrets. And I think your own story of what you just told about Lisa, all the emails that you got and women saying, oh, I know, now I know I'm not alone. I think that's one of the biggest things whenever you talk about one of the heavier topics on a radio program and you start giving your personal experience, whether you were a single mom, whether you'd been through a divorce or whatever that the situation is, you get these emails saying, oh, thank you. I thought I was the only one. And I think that's one of the, I mean, it's not the only benefit of being able to talk about some of these issues, but I think it opens the door to women to realize, okay, I'm not alone. And all right, I now see I need to do something more about it. I need to get into relationships with other women so that I can talk about it.
Well, and it amazes me because it's kind of like the same thing I tell people about sin. It's like, how many different types of sin do we really think are out there? I mean, it's kind of like you're going to pick one of them. You know, you're probably going to struggle with several, and everyone is dealing with one of the same categories, you know?
Right.
So it's just kind of, we always think we're in this.
I know.
Like
I don't know
said,
how we think we're alone, but but that's humanity.
Why do people not understand that I am messed up? Because you know, I thought it was obvious, but you know, really.
Well, I think we grab onto the fact that that our situation, there are certain specifics that are like no one else's situation. And actually, in reality, a lot of times even the specifics are like other people's situations. But sometimes we just need to hear it and have that sense that, again, that, you know, I'm not the only one, even though you know it in your head. I think we do know that in our head, but sometimes it helps to hear it.
Yeah. So what made you realize, as you, because you have hosted this show for 10 years now for Moody, what made you realize that this was the time to start compiling some of these stories and start letting women know that they are not alone?
Well, to be honest, I think my own age. You know, I turned 50 this past year, and there's something about reaching middle age, even though I kind of doubt I'll make it to 100. there's something about reaching kind of that middle age point that as a woman and as a Christian woman, I sort of felt like I was finding my own voice and had some of my own experiences to share. And I actually realized that this was not just about telling other women's stories. It was about telling my own story and some of the secrets that I had kept for so many years. And in the same way that, that women email and say, thank you, I now know I'm not alone, their emails into me helped me realize the very same thing. I had been struggling with loneliness inside the context of church and realized I had a ton of acquaintances, but no deep experience of community and friendship. And even though I'd interviewed some fantastic people through the years, you know, even someone like me who had access to some of the, you know, Christian greats, you know, you think of John Townsend, Henry Cloud, and Max Lucado, you know, you go down the list, same people you get to talk to too. Even someone like me was struggling with this, and I felt like that was important for me to share and to talk about my own story and give other women permission to tell their story. I think often when we tell our stories, it builds up the faith of other believers.
Sure. Yeah. So did you think in your own story, and maybe, you know, you need to just tell us a couple caveats of that, Anita. Was there a shame in that? I mean, did you think, you know, what am I doing hosting this show? You know, maybe I need, so where did you land?
You know, I'll go back to the year 2000. The month that I was asked to be the permanent full-time host of Midday Connection, my marriage started falling apart. Well, I'm a PK, grew up the daughter of a Baptist minister. I mean, the word the word divorce was not in my vocabulary. I mean, it's not acceptable, not something that you would consider, not, you know, you can go down the list. Many listening totally understand that. In fact, I would sit in judgment of others who were going through a divorce. And in my head, I would think, come on, can't you get your act together? Go to counseling. And, mm-hmm. you know, you stood before God and everyone else. And, you know, my judging muscle was really, really strong. Mm-hmm. It was like Arnold Schwarzenegger level.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, I was a really, really good Pharisee. Kind of oxymoron there, isn't it? Anyway, so my marriage started to crumble because of some serious issues that touched on domestic violence and sexual addiction. And, you know, I talk a little bit more about it in the book, though I don't go into great detail. But how could I keep hosting this program? How could I even just emotionally keep doing what I'm doing and be going through this? And how on earth in my Christian circles I could probably more easily be forgiven for committing murder than for going through a divorce. Mm. And that was really, really hard. I felt a tremendous amount of shame. Mm-hmm. And I really have not talked about it on the air until now.
Wow.
Came to a point where I realized, you know what, I really need to talk about this, not in the sense of, you know, flaunting this story. It's not a pretty story. It's a difficult story, a sad story. But 10 years down the road, I have seen God's transforming work, his redemption in the story. And that's the only thing that makes it worth talking about.
Sure. Well, and I think it's valuable to note, especially for our audience, that you could have easily looked back. I'm sure you felt like your own voices and the other, you know, silent voices of others were saying, well, why'd you get into that marriage in the first place? What did you do wrong? What did you pick the wrong person?
Absolutely.
Did you, you know, certainly, or then you didn't work on it enough or whatever. Yeah. And I know a lot of women are paralyzed, you know, single women of just, oh, you know, I want this happily ever after. And I don't want this to be my story. So they're just, you know, paralyzed by choosing the person or, you know, oh, I don't want to settle. I don't know. But we don't know. We can't, you know,
you can't
harness sin and figure
out
what
the future. You can't plan what another person is going to do. And you can't. I think the other thing, you do have this sense, especially growing up in conservative evangelical circles. I knew what I used to think mm-hmm. about other people. And I would have this sense that people would be walking up to me and that I would need to defend myself to every person I came in contact with. Well, mm-hmm. that's not realistic. It's not even appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I really had struggled with that and had to get over that. Mm-hmm. And also realize that I think we handle specifically the divorce issue poorly in the church. Mm-hmm. I think we don't care well for people. Are there people that get unbiblical divorces? Absolutely, every day. Mm-hmm. But does that mean they're not hurting and bleeding and that we leave them by the side of the road? No, I think we need to help bind up their wounds and take care of them and help them move forward. And I have full confidence in God that he can redeem their story. Mm-hmm. You know, if they get into relationship with him or go deeper in relationship with him, he will do a work in them if they open themselves up to him. And I have to trust God. I can't do anything about it. You know, but God is the mover and shaker in someone else's world.
Yeah. I had a mentor tell me once she had gone through a divorce. Her husband had been unfaithful and, you know, had been verbally abusive. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, Lisa, she said, I was quickly able to forgive him for the verbal abuse. I was even able to forgive him for the infidelity, but it took me years to forgive him for making me a divorced woman.
Yes.
And it was, you know, just that when you introduce yourself to someone, well, here's my story. And it's just, you know,
I couldn't say the word for at least 2.5 years. I would, and I still very often say I went through a failed marriage. Mm-hmm. I hate the word divorce. It just, it brings up all of that baggage in my Christian past and even present, depending on what circles you're in.
Yeah. So what are some of the other, you know, this is so timely because just last night I'm in a Beth Moore study, Believing God.
Yes.
And last night's lesson was she brought all these women in the video portion, brought all these women up on stage and put on jackets. And on the back of the jackets were a letter, each a different letter.
Okay.
The first one was a D for divorce. Mm-hmm. And it was the stigma around that. There was a C for crazy, how everyone thinks I'm crazy because I have a bona fide mental condition mm-hmm. and I need to be on meds for that, or because because of XYZ in my past. You know, there were other ones of just a victim or abuse or other things that women are carrying. And instead of trying to cloak that, you know, we need to recognize that the redemption of Christ and the power of community has the ability to excise that to replace it with God's grace. So what are some of the other things that you discovered from women?
Well, you know, I talk about sexual addiction, and that has to be the number one kind of email that we receive. Mm-hmm. You know, a woman saying, my husband is addicted to pornography. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge piece of my personal story. And I talk about it because, that as a woman, it's like we are being attacked, if you will, at the very core of who we are. You know, our sexuality is so core to who we are. And what happens when we're married to a sexual addict, it scares us to death on many levels. I think we're paralyzed by fear. And I think the church is really paralyzed by fear surrounding this issue. And we struggle to, it's very messy and very difficult. And we struggle to get in relationship with people. I think a lot of times I sense this in the emails that I receive, that this has been a deep, dark secret in this woman's life for a long time. Maybe she's known about it and has not dared tell anyone. And, you know, when you keep it in the dark, it will just grow. When you bring it into the light, that's when there is that opportunity for healing and for change, for transformation. Now, you have to be careful. It's not like you broadcast that to the world.
Right.
You know, but you've got to...
Let's not sit at Cracker Barrel and just start telling the people at the table next to
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but you've got to... The man in your life, you know, he's got to get into a relationship of accountability. You do have to set some pretty firm boundaries depending on the kind of situation you're in. And you have got to have some two or three close female friends that you are able to share this with who can pray for you. I remember being at a point where I couldn't even pray for myself or what the situation. I needed other people to carry me and pray. Mm-hmm. And that's what the body of Christ can do.
Yeah.
That's a biggie. I talk about friendships. I think we struggle as women forming friendships, maintaining friendships, developing them.
Yeah.
I go through my own
which
really
is funny.
Failed
all the guys
history.
On the show listening right now are like, seriously? Like, all I see are you women like, can you go out to coffee and you go blah, blah, blah. So that's a perception they have. So what are you saying?
Well, I think it's different. I think there's a group of women that does that and may go deep. But I think there's a group of women that does that and all they talk about are, little Johnny had poopy diapers today and this is what's going on. And little things are happening with my son. But we don't get into the deeper things of life. When we have some of the big secrets, like, you know, my teenager is drug addicted. I've got a daughter who's got an eating disorder and is cutting. I've got this prodigal child I've been praying for years, and I don't even know where he is. I've not heard from him in 2 years. I think when you get to some of those kind of things, you bury them and choose not to go out to coffee. You're afraid to open up, and you are so isolated. Mm-hmm. Then when you get issues like domestic violence, sexual addiction, maybe a spouse who's struggling with gambling, you become isolated even by their behavior too. And but coming back to the relational component, you know, we've got to go beyond small talk. And I think it's wonderful to get together and do scrapbooking and things like that, but that can't be the end. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a means.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. It's got, you know, it can be an avenue to deeper relationship, but we've got to go deeper than that. My situation opened the door. I mean, I literally knocked on a neighbor's door that I didn't know all that well. And I said, my marriage just hit a semi head on. Can I come in and talk to you? Now, that's not the way you want to start a friendship, really, but desperation will drive you to do it. And God used it. And that friendship is unbelievably strong and beautiful to this day. Hmm. I think also the other issue with friendships, a lot of times we live out and move into friendships the way we saw it modeled in our family of origin.
Yeah.
And if you didn't see it modeled well, then it can be a real point of struggle for you. Hmm. And it does take risk. If you've been through a betrayal by a friend, you know, there's another level there that you have to get over. And the other question, I can hear people's minds going, how do I know if someone's safe? That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. And I talk about safe, what's a safe person in the book. And it's not my own ideas. I'm thankful for Henry Cloud and John Townsend, who really outline that well. And I just really reiterate what they have to say about what makes a safe person, because that's important.
Yeah.
Some of our people pickers are broken.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
Well, yeah, that's true. So what, just kind of as we wrap up here, what would you say, Anita, is, you know, especially for, we're talking to, you know, folks who are college through 30s, mostly single, and many of them are saying, okay, well, I want that level of friendship. The women are for sure, you know, there are guys out there who are just desperate to get into solid relationships as well. And it's a much, you know, seems to be a more difficult path sometimes for them. How can they move into a friendship that is going to be solid and that is going to be deep, and to identify those safe people and know, you know what, okay, I hope I'm not going to have to spend five, you know, years of watching reality TV with this person or bowling with them or going to movies or whatever before we can get real. I mean, there are so many single young adults that are just like, I just want someone who's real. How do we find the real people? Put out a sign, I guess.
and sometimes that's a deal. You know, I loved Alexander the Great's quote, you know, the more I get to know people, the more I love my dog. Mm-hmm. you know, it's funny, but there's also that sad truth in it that I think sometimes we are afraid that we're going to get into community with someone we kind of wish we weren't, and that oh no, they're going to be in my small group for 10 years or whatever, just what you said. Mm-hmm. I think you enter it prayerfully. I think you have to test the water with someone. It is an issue of time spent. Mm-hmm. It really is. When I knocked on my neighbor's door and, you know, kind of spilled my story to her, our kids were at the same bus stop. Well, we started walking around the block every day. Then it was two blocks, then three, and then I'd get in my car and go into work. It has to be time spent outside of, you know, your get together at church on Monday night or Wednesday, whatever. You know, you might see that person that you think, man, you know what? I think there's something more to them. That looks like a godly person that I'd like to hang out with. You might have to risk and make that phone call and say, hey, can we do coffee? And I even suggest, you know, sharing a medium size confidence. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of weeks later, asking them if they, you know, did you tell that to anybody? And, you know, I think before you dive into the deep end of the pool, I think some of those things need to be in place.
Sure.
And you need to pay attention to if this is a person that draws you closer to God, a person that draws you closer to other people, doesn't try and isolate you or keep them to yourself. Mm-hmm. And someone also that helps you open up to your authentic self, because that is is also a very positive thing, because it's going to help you grow in your relationship with God. And so it's, you know, unfortunately, there's not a one word answer to it.
Yeah.
And it takes time and some work.
Yeah. It's true. Well, and I think one of the most valuable things that you said was when you said at the front end, you know, I'm now 50 years old, and to recognize, you know, especially now as you're talking to those who are younger, you know, those who are young adults, to say, you don't have to wait until you're 50 to put your story out there and to find people not only from whom you can gain some healing and from whom you can share, but to start talking to those who are coming up behind you and to say,
please,
you know, to say, I mean, because there are teen girls in the church, there are college age girls in the church who are floundering. I mean, and guys too. I mean, it's just, it's necessary. It's not only helpful and healing, but it is necessary to start telling that.
Hugely, I think, especially for this millennial generation. I mean, you know, it's a broken generation. They're more open about their brokenness, but they are desperate for those kind of mentors to come alongside and, you know, and speak the truth and to help in that healing process.
That's cool. Well, it's Anita Lestria, everyone. Again, she is the host of Moody's Midday Connection, and she is now the author of What Women Tell Me, Finding Freedom from the Secrets We Keep. Definitely would recommend that you check this book out. Not only the ladies, you guys, if you've been hanging in with us, please check it out. You guys are always saying, you know, we need to find out what these ladies are thinking. Well, here you
there
go.
There you go.
Here you can get a few things and good discussion starters, especially for small groups and just as you're hanging out with your friends, and really to start opening some of those conversations. So we'll go ahead and link to that on the blog so you can kind of get a quick path to finding out about that, as well as the show. Make sure you check out the show when you get a chance, because Anita's really a fun host, and they cover really a wide range of stuff. So Anita, thank you so much.
Hey, great to be with you, Lisa. Thanks.
Hey everyone, we are opening up this week's inbox and we are privileged to have Danny Huerta back in the studio with us. Hey Danny.
Hi, how you doing, Lisa? Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for showing up because we've got quite a question for you today.
Yeah, so again,
we're gonna need we'll need some good insight for this. So I'm going to give you a little bit of the backstory and see if we can kind of launch into this. So here we go. This is one of our listeners. She says, I have dreams almost every night. Usually they're random and sometimes pretty funny, but other times I do things in them which I would be ashamed to tell anyone about. These are almost always sexually themed dreams. I've never had a dream in which I actually engaged in intercourse, but there are other sexual elements such as touching, kissing, or occasional nudity. Often they are with my boyfriend, but they've also been with faceless, unreal guys. Once or twice it's been with a guy I know other than my boyfriend. I'm unsure why I'm dreaming these things. Are my dreams just me fulfilling my unconscious wishes, or could it possibly be Satan putting these dreams in my head? I know myself, and I know I'm very attracted to sexuality. I cannot wait to have sex, and thus I'm often tempted sexually. My boyfriend and I were physical for a few months, and I'm pretty sure I had at least a couple of sexually themed dreams during that time. I know it's a natural desire to want to have sex, but when I have these dreams, I feel guilty about their sexual themes. Where is my guilt coming from?
Well, Lisa, dreams are interesting because what they do is the purpose of dreams is to consolidate what our day has been like. And sometimes that can look very strange. You can have some really, really crazy dreams where they don't make sense at all. And then there's some that have certain themes that repeat over and over again. Usually that's an indication of what you're thinking about emotionally, an implicit dream where you're having, or implicit memories where you're having a lot of thoughts on one theme. Some people will try to solve problems before they go to bed. Let's say, I remember one time I was trying to put a sprinkler system together and I thought about it, thought about different ways to do that. And that night I even walked in my sleep and went to the back door, kind of picturing doing this thing. That's a very rare occurrence, but I was so focused on that. And there was emotional pressure to get it done. I was really thinking about it. There's really, in the study of dreams, if you look at when people have the most intense dreams, it's when they're thinking about something a lot. And it seems that this particular individual has been focused very much so on trying not to have sex with somebody, with her boyfriend, or just keeping herself pure, which is a good thing. And it is really a usual thing, a common thing, to have an attraction towards sexuality. That's how God designed us. It seems that her life right now is very focused on that topic. And so to feel guilt around these dreams, I guess there really isn't anything that would warrant guilt in this particular situation. I understand where her guilt's coming from because of her desire to remain pure. We can't control our dreams. It'd be nice if we could. Mm-hmm. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? You could just kind of decide your theme that night. Mm-hmm. One thing that she could begin to do is, before she goes to bed at night, maybe that's when she has her Bible study, or that's when she refocuses on other things. Maybe reviews what things are going to be happening the next day, what she's hoping to accomplish, those things. That will lessen the amount of dreams that are sexual. Now, usually dreams occur in about 25% of our dream cycle. So they go in between the stages. I don't know if you remember, Lisa, when you start falling asleep and you're super tired and you feel like you're falling from somewhere and then you wake up, mm-hmm. that's usually the brain skipping steps because you're so super tired that it's wanting to go right to the deepest sleep. And so it in essence skips the REM sleep, which is where you dream. And the purpose of that dream time is to allow the rest of your body to have a rest. So when you're dreaming, you really can't move your body. Sometimes people will, like they're walking their sleep or smack someone next to them, you know, those types of things. But there's a portion of that where they don't have any movement of their body. And so for her, there's that inhibition, there's that desire for sex, and then her brain emotionally is trying to process that and consolidating it, and that's where she's getting these sexual dreams.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. One thing she doesn't really address in her letter is what she is doing when she is awake, like where this relationship is, you know, what in reality. And so I think, I mean, not that I necessarily think, like you said, I mean, a dream, you know, we're not going to have control over that. But where is her relationship in real time with this guy? Is he a viable, I mean, is, you know, we don't really know who's a believer here, where their faith is, what they're doing in the relationship as far as whether they are sexually active on some level and whether they backed off, or, you know, are they actually moving toward marriage? You know, I mean, it almost mm-hmm. feels like she's not, you know, realizing that, you know, they're not married. And so there are some things she can think about, some things she can't think about. And maybe she's saying that, well, now my dreams are kind of, you know, acting on that or on, you know, wishes or something like that. Because like you said, I mean, there are very real things that she can't control in the dreams, but there are real behaviors that she can control in real life. Does any of that play into this, do you think?
Or? Definitely. I mean, where she can't control she cannot control the dreams. She can't control what's going on during the day. So we wonder what is going on. And if you think through kind of her, this particular letter, there's some themes here where she's experienced a certain level of sexuality with this particular young man. Mm. And through that experience, it's created for her brain something to draw on. Mm-hmm. And so maybe maintaining those boundaries. But if you think about it, like let's say in this room we had a clock and I said, Lisa, don't listen to that clock. What your brain's going to do, it's going to listen to the clock. So mm-hmm. if she's constantly thinking, I can't think about sex, I can't think about this stuff, I can't have these dreams, that's what her brain's going to focus on. So maybe it'd be good for her to define what she wants during this time. And sexuality is not a bad thing. God created it. It's when we become over-focused on it that it mm-hmm. becomes an issue, because it almost becomes an idol, a god, and it consumes our life. So maybe a good answer to this would be balancing that out, recognizing that she is a sexual being, she will have sex at some point, but not allowing that to become the focus of the relationship and the purpose for her getting married. Mm-hmm. That is something she'll enjoy in time.
Right.
Yeah. And that may reduce some of her dreams.
Yeah. And we don't really know her age here, but of course, if she is of marriable age, that, you know, that's, we often say here on Boundless, well, you know, there's one of the good motivators for marriage is to have sex and, you know, to, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. to protract your singleness and prolong your journey towards marriage, you know, is, unless there are bona fide reasons for doing so. I mean, right. ultimately, yeah, if her boyfriend is a good match and they're moving towards marriage and they have a structure of accountability and others in their sphere, you know, especially older, mature Christians believe that, you know, they would form a good marriage, then she could probably look, you know, towards expressing healthy sexuality in marriage and, you know, not feel like she's in this black hole of now I'm just stuck with these dreams because I can't act on any of this stuff. So
that's right. Yeah.
So, you know, there is hope in that, in her reality, mm-hmm. you know, and like you said, that might play into some of the dreams.
A lot
as
of
well.
Times our sexuality as well is emotionally based. And mm-hmm. so I'm wondering here if just in exploring, being able to ask her questions, what emotionally is she trying to meet through sexuality? There may be some gaps there where she's needing more nurturance, more closeness emotionally mm-hmm. with her boyfriend or with people in general. And she's learned that closeness equates that sexual touch. That, mm-hmm. And that is a part of it. But maybe emotionally, maybe there's a part here where she needs to explore how to meet it in a different way.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question and a great, great answer. Great thoughts, Danny. And I just really appreciate her being willing to share it because, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's, you know, something that people think about and probably other people have experienced as well. So
well, it can be an embarrassing topic to just share with friends. Hey,
right.
I've been having these sexual dreams. What do you guys yeah. think? You know,
throw it out at Bible study, awkward. See what people say, right. you know, or in Sunday school. That'd be awesome. So, well, thanks so much, Danny, for weighing in on that one. Okay, that is it for this week's show, everyone. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us, editor@boundless.org, so we can address your question at some point on a future show. Or if you resonated with this one or have some insight or just have some additional questions, maybe you have a similar situation, do write to us as well and we'll try to address that. But all that said, we're glad to have you as part of the show. Until next week, I'm your host Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.